10 a.m. in London, 5 a.m. in Washington, midday in Nairobi. This is Dan Damon at the BBC. Germany, Austria and the Czech Republic impose controls on their borders to help deal with the massive influx of people wanting to enter Europe. I've been speaking to an MP from Angela Merkel's party.
They have to present their papers, their documents, their passport, and then it is necessary to do the registration. It is necessary to know where they are coming from.
The moment when one man waits to be reunited with his twin brother after a lifetime apart, separated at birth at the end of World War II.
I feel very happy. I cannot wait to hug him and give him a big kiss.
Facebook and Google are buying up robotics firms. AI companies are hiring the leading academics. So will robots take our jobs? And Buzz Aldrin touches down in London, but he's looking to Mars. That's on World Update after the news.
Hello, I'm Sue Montgomery with the BBC News. Egyptian security forces have attacked a tourist convoy in a desert region after mistaking the visitors for militants. Egypt says 12 people were killed, including Mexican tourists. From Cairo, Orla Guerin.
Egyptian officials say the tourists were in a no-go zone and had not liaised with the authorities. But a local tour guide has denied that. He said the group was in an unrestricted area on top of sand dunes, trying to get a bird's eye view. Another local source, who claims to have spoken to a driver who survived the incident, told the BBC the tour company had coordinated with officials and even had a police escort.
The Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott has announced there will be a vote for the leadership of the governing Liberal Party later on Monday, after he was challenged by his colleague Malcolm Turnbull. Mr Abbott said he expected to remain leader.
The Prime Ministership of this country is not a prize or a plaything to be demanded. It should be something which is earned by a vote of the Australian people. There will be a party room ballot for both the leadership and the deputy leadership positions later this evening. I will be a candidate and I expect to win.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says European countries must urgently find a comprehensive response to the influx of migrants after various states started to introduce their own border controls. The UNHCR's spokesperson, Melissa Fleming, said the European Union had to create effective reception centres for those arriving.
We're not suggesting that these be refugee camps where people stay for long periods of time. They're reception and processing centres. Mm-hmm. Those determined to be in need of international protection are relocated. Those who are not are sent back to their homes in a humane and dignified way. We can't have a situation where what we see today, where each individual country makes a decision on its border controls, basically shoving the problem down the line.
The British Prime Minister David Cameron is visiting Lebanon to see how British aid, worth more than $1.5 billion, has been spent there. Speaking at a camp near the Syrian border, Mr Cameron said British money was saving hundreds of thousands more Syrians from having to travel to Europe.
I wanted to come here to see for myself and to hear for myself the stories of refugees and what they need. I'm also appointing a specific minister with responsibility for Syrian refugees to make sure that the 20,000 that we have promised to resettle, that that happens rapidly, it happens well, and the whole country pulls together to deliver that.
The British Prime Minister David Cameron. World News from the BBC. Afghan officials say Taliban militants have stormed a prison in the central city of Ghazni, releasing at least 350 inmates. Reports say one militant blew himself up in front of the prison gates, opening the way for the rest of the attackers. It's the biggest mass prisoner escape in Afghanistan since 2011. Malaysian police have arrested three people in connection with a deadly bomb attack last month on a shrine in the Thai capital, Bangkok. Malaysia's police chief said two of its citizens and a Pakistani were detained. Jonathan Head reports.
The Thai police have suggested the attack was the work of people smuggling gangs, responding to increased pressure on their business in Thailand. But some of those named on the 12 arrest warrants issued so far are Turkish, and one is a Chinese Muslim from Xinjiang province. These factors appear to support a different theory, that the bomb may have been in retaliation for the controversial deportation by Thailand in July of more than 100 Muslim Uyghurs who'd been seeking asylum back to China.
There's been a second day of clashes at the Al-Aqsa compound in Jerusalem between Israeli police and Palestinian youths. The police said that masked youths threw stones at them before running into the mosque. The police operation at the compound, sacred to both Muslims and Jews, coincides with the Jewish New Year. Tensions have been high since last week. Research by Britain's Meteorological Office suggests the years 2014 to 2016 are likely to be among the warmest on record around the world. The organisation warns that big changes could be underway in the climate system, with greenhouse gases increasing the impact of natural trends. Novak Djokovic has won the US Open Tennis Championship for the second time, beating Roger Federer in a thrilling final. The Serb took his third Grand Slam title of the year and his 10th overall. BBC News.
Hello, you're listening to World Update from the BBC World Service in London. Coming up, a question you might have pondered quite a lot in recent years. Will a robot take your job? Well, today our technology correspondent will tell you which kinds of roles are most likely and least likely to be taken over by artificial intelligence. Plus, why in China sometimes it's better to kill the person you've knocked over or otherwise injured in an accident than take the rap for the injury. My guest Jeffrey Sant will tell us about what's called in China hit to kill.
Those kind of incidents, it's just impossible to believe they don't know what they're doing. And in China, the mainstream media, the government, they recognize that this is a real phenomenon. People's Daily has published two editorials in just the past 4 years talking about hit-to-kill incidents and trying to essentially persuade the public that these are bad ideas, that you will get arrested for murder. Don't do it. But it continues.
More on that in about 15 minutes' time. But of course, we're looking at what's causing so many thousands of people to flee towards Europe. We'll talk about the changes to border regulations in just a moment in Germany and other parts of Europe. First, the US general leading the coalition against the so-called Islamic State group says progress has been made in the last year, but it will be a long fight. General John Allen said Iraq risked collapse, but was now challenging IS. Our Middle East correspondent Quentin Somerville has asked General Allen how the coalition could fight the war against ISIS effectively without combat troops on the ground.
I think you have to make a decision early along in a crisis like this. You have to decide whether you want to fight it yourself or you want the solution to the crisis to end up being in the hands of the indigenous forces themselves.
So that's the right decision. You're comfortable with the fact that American soldiers and British soldiers are not fighting on the ground in Syria and Iraq?
I've got a lot of experience dealing with indigenous forces and training indigenous forces. It works out much better at the end because when Western forces insert themselves in large numbers and engage in high-end combat operations in a region like that, the outcome is almost always that you create as much instability as a result of that as you do accomplish your tactical objective. And we've had some setbacks. We certainly have. But we're in no position right now to say that this process isn't working.
In Syria, people have suffered there and been suffering there for years.
Yes, they have.
For many now, particularly with the threat of the Islamic State, it's too much. So they've left. And there are tens of thousands, and they've come to Europe, terrified, scared, looking for refuge. Do you feel responsible?
I feel that we can help them. We've worked very hard to help in the humanitarian crisis in that region. The United States has been the largest donor, just to the Syrians alone, $4 billion since 2011. Your country has been very active. We've got to solve the conflict, though, and the conflict's got to be solved both at a political level and a global level. The manifestation of that conflict will play out in a number of ways. Right now it's playing out in this heart-wrenching visage of the people who are streaming out of the region. And the instability that has been created by the Bashar al-Assad and that regime and his unwillingness to listen early in the Arab Spring to the voices of his people who just sought political change, as so many others did. He ultimately chose to attack them and ultimately chose to make war upon his own people. And that ultimately created the crisis that we face today. Bashar al-Assad has got to go. He is both a point and a representation of what has caused so much instability in the region and so many people to want to fight.
Do you think that the Islamic State could be capable of a 9/11 style attack? And if they are capable of that, would we be able to stop them?
There is no doubt that they would intend to bring some kind of a catastrophic attack to our homelands. Whether they have the capability remains to be determined. We have worked very hard in the United States with our intelligence community and our efforts overseas to do all that we can to attack the problem at its point of origin in Syria or Iraq, to wear it down as it might be coming at us, and then ultimately to defend the country at our borders. And so we have to organize with each other and organize inside our own countries to provide the kind of defense necessary to reduce to the maximum extent we can the possibility of a catastrophic attack.
Do you have to do more?
I don't think we're ever going to be satisfied we've done enough. I think that's the important thing. That's the goal that we should have. And if we wake up every morning wondering what more we could do to protect our people and our homelands, that's the best attitude to have.
General John Allen, the U.S. general leading the coalition against the self-styled Islamic State. This is World Update from the BBC. And, of course, the unrest in the Middle East is one of those factors driving people to flee at great personal cost and danger towards Europe. The United Nations has appealed for a comprehensive European response to the migrant crisis after several EU members introduced new border controls. Britain has appointed a minister for Syrian refugees, and Germany, Austria and Czech Republic have tightened border controls. Gavin Lee is our reporter in Brussels. What is the practical effect of these tighter border controls, Gavin?
Well, I think it's leading now to a real confusion within Europe about how countries should operate. You have Germany all of a sudden saying it can no longer cope with this open-door system, imposing controls overnight on its border with Austria. Austria, for 12 hours last night, stopped the trains running through to Germany. There's talk of the army in Austria helping impose its borders and reinforce visas and people showing passports. So the idea of the Schengen, this visa-free travel through Europe, really is being tested. They have countries an opt-out for several weeks where they can temporarily suspend the Schengen agreement. But from where I'm talking to you in Brussels at the moment, you know, this all comes to a pressure point today, because all of the countries, the EU member states, are supposed to agree to a migrant plan put forward by the European Commission. Its head, Jean-Claude Juncker, said in the last few days they have to prove, all of these EU states, that there is not complete disunity in the European Union. And at the moment, it appears that way. But the idea is for 160,000 migrants, refugees, to be shared, parceled out between member states. And given the Germany's position, there is clear pressure now to say we cannot cope. Other countries have to participate more in this.
What's supposed to happen, I think, is that people present their papers at borders. And if you're a Syrian and you can claim asylum, all well and good. But I'm sure it's hard to find out the detail. But a lot of people simply don't have that kind of identity document when they've come across in some of the conditions that they faced.
Yeah, I've spent time in Greece, in Izmir as well, as the boats go. I've watched smugglers telling people to throw their passports into the sea. I've heard and spoke to many migrants, refugees, who say that actually they know the best way to be fast-tracked is to say that they're Syrian. I've met Iraqis who have, in Kos, for example, who said that the best thing that they could do is to say they were Syrian and lose their papers, because they know that is the best way. And of course, that puts pressure on the border police, and that only adds to the emphasis of why countries are starting to suspend the Schengen agreement, because of the political situation with how countries view Syria right now. The other point to briefly mention today, there's this big meeting between interior ministers. They're supposed to come up with an agreement for the migration strategy, not just a quota system for 160,000, but also fast-tracking measures to send back economic migrants and those who fail in their asylum applications back to countries of safe origin, the Balkan states, for example, Turkey. But I tell you what, there is big disunity amongst the states about that. There are lots of human rights lawyers, there are lots of MEPs I've spoken to who say that wherever you are, if you're fleeing persecution in any sense, so they may not, particularly in Slovakia, for example, agree to that part either. So big pressure today.
Thank you, Gavin, and he'll be covering that meeting for us later here on the BBC World Service and our partner stations. The great Kali is back in India. He's been fighting WWE, pro wrestling, in the US. Now he's setting up an academy. Nitin Srivastava has travelled to the city of Jalandhar and spent a day with the great Kali.
It's a busy day for budding wrestlers from various parts of India. Full of enthusiasm, they are being trained by the former pro wrestling champion, the great Kali, at his recently opened wrestling academy. And Coach Khali is as relentless in training as he was during his WWE days.
There are about 20 students who just finished 200 plus rounds of push-ups on the wrestling arena, and their co-trainees are clapping, are pumping their fist as the numbers of the push-ups increases. It's mind-boggling. The atmosphere is tremendous. It's terrific. Most of them carrying the dreams of becoming a WWE superstar like the great Khali himself.
Rita Rani is 35 years of age and she travels more than 100 miles to train under Khali's guidance.
I was always jealous watching foreign girls participating in wrestling at the WWE arena. I always wondered why Indian women couldn't reach that stage. So the moment I heard of Khali's academy, I simply rushed here. For me, it's wrestling which matters now. And that's why I don't even want to marry. This sport has name, fame and money. Plus, I can travel abroad as well.
It certainly is a homecoming of sorts for this 2.5 meter tall man who weighs almost 200 kilos. Khali, whose real name is Dilip Singh Rana, used to work as a laborer in his teenage to support his six siblings.
Going to US and participating at WWE was a dream. When I couldn't find people to sponsor me here in Punjab, I collected all my savings and landed in San Francisco to train. Looking at my extraordinary physique, some suggested to find work at the warehouse, and some asked me to join a group of nightclub bouncers. But I was determined to learn wrestling, come what may.
Meanwhile, students like Gurinder Singh are now looking at a future only under Khali's guidance.
Pehle main accountant tha. MM University hai Mulana mein.
I was an accountant by profession, but people used to tease me over my 7 foot height. Then I began thinking, I can do wonders in wrestling, and that's why I'm here. Since 3 boys from the academy have already gone to train at WWE in US, I think now my future is secure as well.
Despite poverty and hardships, Khali's devotion to wrestling brought fame. At one point, when Khali was beating the likes of The Undertaker in the ring, he was earning more than $1 million every year in the WWE. Even opting for a US citizenship hasn't prevented him from returning to India.
I am not a businessman, but have still purchased land and have started this academy in rural India. I want to give something back to my country. This is a misconception amongst Indians that since not everyone is of my physique, they can't become WWE wrestlers. It's a myth which I will change by setting up wrestling academies throughout India. Pro wrestling requires practice and training and not a huge physique.
In a country obsessed with cricket and icons like Sachin Tendulkar, Khali's journey towards stardom has been tremendous. And if he manages to produce a few wrestling champions, he will surely enter the League of Legends.
Nitin Srivastava reporting on the return of the great Khali. This is World Update from the BBC. Don't forget that we like to hear the sounds around you. updatesoundscapes@gmail.com. Also, if you want to tell me what you think about the stories that you hear, at BBC Dan Damon on Twitter is the way to do that. And we have the podcast, the World Update Daily Commute. It is 7 days a week. If you want to, for example, hear our feature about the sensorium at Tate Britain, you can still do that. World Update Daily Commute. Coming up on our programme, artificial intelligence. How threatened should we feel about robots taking over our jobs?
What you're seeing the robot do now, the robot can do in 3 seconds what it would take a group of lawyers days to do. Huge volumes, incredibly reliably, in unbelievable times.
replacing lawyers with robots. Well, you might have a joke about that, but when it's your job, you might feel differently. We'll talk about that a bit later on. Our headlines, 12 people travelling in a tourist convoy in the Egyptian desert have been killed by security forces. We'll have more on that in just a moment. The Australian Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, is facing a ballot later today on his leadership, and the United Nations has appealed for a comprehensive European response to the migrant crisis after several EU members introduced their own border controls. We'll speak to a politician from Angela Merkel's party in Germany just later. Those are the headlines. This is the BBC. This is Dan Damon in London. 12 people travelling in a tourist convoy in the Egyptian deserts have been killed by security forces who said they thought they were militants. Let's talk to our Cairo correspondent, Ola Guerin, who's been following the story. Of course, tourism so important to Egypt, this will not help.
Certainly not. It's a tragedy for Mexico, and frankly, it's a disaster for the Egyptian authorities. They have been trying very energetically to resuscitate the tourism industry, which has suffered hugely since the instability of the revolution of 2011. Now, what we know about this incident comes from the Interior Ministry. Their version of the story is that these tourists were in a convoy of 4x4 vehicles, that they entered a restricted area without permission, that a joint operation was underway at the time involving the police and the army, who were pursuing militants on the move, and that this is how these tourists came to be accidentally targeted, as the ministry put it. We know from the Mexican authorities that two Mexican tourists are confirmed dead. A further five are said to be in stable condition here in hospital in Cairo. We know also that the Mexican ambassador to Egypt managed to speak to those survivors, and we assume he is trying to piece together a detailed account from what they have been able to tell him. But Mexico's president has called for an exhaustive inquiry, and the Mexican authorities are saying that the circumstances of all of this are still very unclear. Now, we have contradictory accounts coming from local sources. One local tour guide has just told the BBC that, in fact, this group was not in a restricted area. He says, as far as he knows, they were on top of a sand dune and they were simply trying to get a bird's eye view of the area. Another local source claims to have spoken to a driver who was in the convoy but survived. He is saying that this tour was organised by a local hotel, that not only had it coordinated with the authorities, but also that this little tour company, these tourists, actually had a police escort at the time when they came under attack. A very different story, of course, to the one the authorities are telling.
So clearly a great deal of confusion. Is this an area where there have been tensions?
Well, it's an area which is becoming a focus of concern in relation to militant activity. It hasn't been regarded until now as a particular militant stronghold, certainly not anything like the Sinai Peninsula, where an insurgency has been raging against the security forces for the past few years and, in fact, it has been gathering in pace. But we do know that there is a militant presence in this area. It's a vast open area that leads to the long and porous border with Libya, over which, of course, militants and weapons can flow. And on Sunday, there was a statement circulating on social media from supporters of the so-called Islamic State, saying that Islamic State had managed to withstand what it described as a military assault. Another statement appeared from a group claiming to be an affiliate of IS, saying that it now had a presence in an area along the Libyan border. And, of course, just last month, the beheading of a Croatian engineer, a young engineer, who had been taken by Islamic State, that took place in the Western Desert. And the fact that the military and the police have been carrying out operations there also signals that they are concerned about a militant presence. Security officials here believe that militants coming across from Libya in the West are trying to link up with militants operating in Sinai to the east, and certainly the desert would be crucial in that effort.
Ola, thank you for updating us on that. That's Ola Guerin, our Cairo correspondent. This is World Update from London. In China, drivers who've injured pedestrians sometimes will then try to kill them. Because if you cripple someone, you can be sued to look after them for the rest of their life. But according to past experience, if you kill someone, you either get a short prison sentence or get fined less money. I've been speaking to Jeffrey Sant. He teaches at Fordham Law School in the US, and he's on the board of the New York Chinese Cultural Center. He told me, indeed, there is this phenomenon known as hit to kill in China.
There's been quite a long series of these hit-to-kill incidents where drivers who hit a person accidentally would then go back and hit them again. In 2010, for example, there was an incident where a man in a Mercedes-Benz was backing up. He hit a child, drove over the child. Then he turned into drive. He drove over the child again. Then he got in reverse, but he got out of the car, put his hand on the car, and walked the car backwards over the child. His foot stepped right next to the child's head. Then he got in the car again and drove over the child and drove away. Those kind of incidents, it's just impossible to believe they don't know what they're doing. And in China, the mainstream media, the government, they recognize that this is a real phenomenon. People's Daily has published two editorials in just the past 4 years talking about hit-to-kill incidents and trying to essentially persuade the public that these are bad ideas, that you will get arrested for murder, don't do it. But it continues.
And the reason is, and they do absolutely know what they're doing, yes, because to pay for somebody's long-term care if they're disabled is more expensive in the current situation in China than to pay compensation for their death.
Tragically, that's exactly right. And, you know, you can try to persuade the public, but as long as there's this perverse financial incentive, there's going to be at least some people who continue doing this, I believe. You know, China's economy has been booming, so the amount of compensation changes over time. But very roughly speaking, the amount of compensation you'd pay for killing a person might be between 20,000 to maybe 70,000 U.S. dollars, the equivalent. But if you injure a person severely, if you cripple them, you could easily pay over $1 million dollars U.S. So the difference there is so massive. You know, in one of the People's Daily editorials, they quoted a truck driver who said, look, roughly speaking, he said, you could be bankrupted, just completely destroyed if you're forced to pay for long-term care for an invalid. If you kill somebody, you know, all of us truck drivers can cover that. And so it's an unspoken rule. Those were his words, an unspoken rule that it's better to hit to kill than to hit and injure.
What about morality, though, Jeffrey?
Yes, and I don't want to mislead people. This certainly doesn't happen in every traffic accident and certainly not in the vast majority of traffic accidents. Most people find this horrific. When the videos have come out of people driving back and forth over a person, the reaction among the public is horror, anger, fury. The government has attempted to persuade the public that this is horrible, and I think everybody's convinced that the problem, you know, just keeps coming back to this perverse financial compensation system that unfortunately incentivizes the people who, I guess, are cold-blooded enough or scared in that moment and decide, you know, I don't want my life destroyed, I'm going to destroy this person's life instead.
Is there any way the government can make this a criminal offense? Because it is so obviously, and as you say, it's a small number of cases, but each one deeply significant. Could the government legislate to make this more costly than doing the right thing, which is to help somebody who you've damaged?
The government in China has attempted to legislate this away, and what they've done is to emphasize that courts should treat these cases as murder, that this is in fact murder, and obviously it is. Unfortunately, as I point out in my article, Driven to Kill, there's a lot of instances where somebody who is even caught on film backing up and driving over repeatedly over a person has been able to somehow convince the court that this was either accidental or I didn't see the person, I thought he was a trash bag, what have you. This keeps happening. And so, you know, I don't think it's enough to say we have to punish this as murder, because in the end, you're going to have to just change that compensation system. And if you kill someone accidentally or intentionally, that has to be at least roughly equivalent to the amount you'd pay for injuring them.
Jeffrey Sant, who is on the board of the New York Chinese Cultural Center and knows the country well on that horrifying phenomenon, hit to kill. You're listening to World Update from the BBC. You can get in touch on Twitter at BBC Dan Damon. Coming up in the next part of our program, how will robots take your job? And in particular, how can you make sure you're safe from the robots? That's after the news.
This is the BBC World Service. The news is in a couple of minutes. After this.
Languages. Many. Population. Huge.
cities, mega. India, the world's largest democracy, is diverse and complex.